Hello and welcome to the podcast portion of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, previews, reviews, and interviews with baseball authors, artists, filmmakers, musicians, anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture. Because that's our slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Many of us have played Strat-O-Matic or some other fantasy version of the game. Robert Kruver wrote the classic baseball fiction, the Universal Baseball Association, Inc., Henry Waugh proprietor. Well, Kruver has some company of Jeff Pullman, who recently released Twin Bill, Further Immersions in Historical Baseball Fiction, his fourth book, which includes a speculative piece about Hank Greenberg, the Hall of Fame first baseman slash outfielder in the years leading up to World War II. I had somewhat of an ulterior motive for speaking with Pullman, since I'm working on my own book about Hammer and Hank. Here's our conversation.
Jeff Pullman, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
How you doing, Ron?
Okay. So, what is this fascination you have with combining fiction with fact when it comes to baseball?
Combining fiction with fact. Well, it's not something that I, set out to do on purpose. I mean, a lot of the books I write, which originally started as blogs, were just done through wanting to do something creative with my constant playing of the Strat-O-Matic tabletop game. And rather than just kind of recount the old season replays I was doing, thought I could maybe create some fiction story and characters to kind of wrap around the action. So that's why whatever happens in the replay, you know, does not match what really happened in real life. I'm using the same season, but doesn't always match. But it just gives me a way to kind of explore creatively and fictionally that world of that whatever particular season that was. For instance, go ahead.
No, go ahead, please.
Well, I was just going to say, 1924, and You Are There, which was my first book. In real life, the Washington Senators and the New York Giants played in the World Series. When I did my replay, the Pittsburgh Pirates were fantastic and ended up winning the National League and playing Washington in the World Series. But that wasn't really, that's not the gist of what I do. It's more of it is you just get more involved in the characters and the stories. That was a kind of a coming of age story about a 17-year-old Phillies fan. So, you know, it becomes something else. Because that's a coming of age. Another one was a murder mystery, and you get more embroiled in the characters and the story. And the baseball in the background it's an arena. It's a setting, but it's not, you know, it's not meant to be the real thing. Just kind of using it as a backdrop, kind of historically.
So you did the first one, 1924, You Were There, and you also did the book Dear Hank. So those are based on real life people, real life teams. What about your other two, Mystery Ball and Ball Nuts?
Okay, well, Ball Nuts was the second one, and that was based on 1977. The original blog was called Play That Funky Baseball, and that was kind of a goof. Because it was the mid-70s, I did kind of a goof on One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, where you had a state hospital in Maine, and all the patients on the ward were baseball fans kind of rooting for different teams, and they, through one process or another, they go through a time warp back to 1977. So we were kind of replaying the best 16 teams from 1977 in a full season replay, but there's a lot of drama going on because the characters are all very different people, and there's a woman psychiatrist who also goes through the time warp and is coming after them. And it's goofy and fun and a little bit sci-fi-ish almost. Mystery Ball 58 was the murder mystery set in San Francisco, the first year the Giants and Dodgers played on the West Coast. That one was a lot of fun, and I think that's my favorite of all the books because I just think it worked the best as far as mixing the genre, like a film noir type thriller with baseball and the culture of its time. was able to get Jack Kerouac into the book and sorted other people from that era. Dear Hank, you mentioned, was actually combined with the Bragging Rights League in my fourth book, my newest book, which is called Twin Bill. Those were shorter blogs, so they lasted about 6 months instead of a year, so I called them Blog Ellas.
So these all started out as blogs?
They all started out as blogs that ran. Most of them ran for about a year, and as I said, the last two ran for about 6 months apiece. The advantage of going to the blog, looking at the blog, is that you get a little more, it's a little more visually, it's a little more fun to get to see a lot more artwork, old vintage photos and stuff like that. The downside is that it's much more of a chore to get through the story. That way you have to keep clicking on the next chapter, so to speak. And, you know, it's a serialized thing, but the book versions are actually also edited down somewhat and a little more streamlined because the blogs have much more of the game replay action every day. And I took out a whole large chunks of that for the book.
So what led to the decision to publish as books? Why not just leave them as blogs?
I just thought they lent themselves to book forms, particularly because I had, I had a lot of good response from the blogs and thought that, well, might as well try to condense it into a book form and do kind of create something with it. I did approach a few agents about it, and, it got kind of lukewarm response. I got the standard response that there's just people aren't buying baseball books now, which is baloney because there are constant baseball books, as you know, and even fiction ones. So that I didn't buy that. I just thought, well, my stuff is might be a little quirky for some people, but I have a following, so I'm going to do it. And I really enjoy doing the self-publishing thing through Amazon because during the day I'm a graphic artist, and I was able to create the interior of the books, have it give it a certain look, and work on controlling the art for the cover. And to me, that gave me a lot of satisfaction, and not something I probably would have been able to do if it was going through a conventional publisher.
So your professor day job gives you a bit of a leg up, I think, on a lot of self-publishing authors.
Oh, yeah, for sure. For instance, Mystery Ball 58, I hired a really, really great graphic designer named Bethany Heck, who does the Ephes League, and
does she still do
got
that?
Her. She still does it. She's doing other things. She has, yeah, she's doing other things. She has a day job up in Seattle, but she does. She still does the Ephes League. She has a half-liner scorebook that she sells through that. That's just wonderful. And she did the cover for Mystery Ball and also the banner for the blog. The interior I designed myself. I used a particular font that Black Lizard Press used in the 1950s for their pulp mystery thrillers with a kind of a two-column format. And I just wanted it to look like an old-style pulp thriller on the inside.
But it's interesting you say that because I don't know, having a couple of books done myself, I don't know what kind of decision goes into what font you use. I mean, is there something very psychological about it? Because to a lay person, I think they don't pay any attention to that kind of thing unless it's really difficult to read if they try to squeeze too many words on a page. But what kind of font? I mean, how many fonts did you consider before you decided on what to use?
Oh, not that many. I just got samples of what I wanted it to look like. And then just, if you go on to InDesign is the software that I used to create it. And if you go on there, they've got just dozens and dozens of fonts with little sample looks at them. You can take a look and try to match it something close. So that's really all you need to do. But again, it's just a sense, I think, just because I'm a graphic artist, I also got more of a sense of the design of something. I don't know about you, but when I'm in a bookstore, I get seduced by book covers. And there's so many good book covers out there. And a lot of what you're saying is absolutely true. With a lot of the self-published stuff, people just don't think to try anything with that. You know what I mean? It's just not. It's not like they don't want it to look good, but it's just maybe just not their. They just don't have a knack for that. You know, don't have an eye for that. But I think it's pretty important to have it. You know, as good looking as you can.
Now, about self-publishing, one of the knocks on it is that it's not vetted enough. It's not. What kind of? Did you have any help in editing? Did somebody look it over for you, or did you just?
Nope. You get absolutely no help from anybody. It's all.
Well, I mean you can have a friend. Engage it yourself.
Yeah, unless you engage, you hire someone to copy edit your stuff or whatever. You just have to read your stuff over and over and over. I'm consider myself a good speller, so I'm never. You know, even though, you know, you still find typos when you're reading it like a month later. But to tell you the truth, I see typos all the time when I read books from big publishers. So I think copy editing is kind of a endangered species. There isn't as much good proofreading going on as there used to be, so things do get through. But the downside of self-publishing, to get back to your question, is they don't. There's absolutely no promotion. There's nothing, nobody to help you do that. That's all I have to do myself on Facebook and Twitter and try to get readings, calling bookstores cold or whatever. That's all self-generated. And it's, you know, it's a struggle. I had one very good reading for Mystery Ball in L.A. last year. Maybe because I live here, a lot of people know me came out. But, you know, trying to do one up in San Francisco wasn't as successful. There's just so much going on up there. I just didn't know a lot of people up there, you know. So I've kind of committed to not bothering doing the readings again for a while unless somebody really, really wants to, you know, hear me read somewhere and makes an effort to contact me. I would do it, but it's not really. It's good to get yourself out there, but it's not. I wouldn't call it the most cost efficient thing.
Yeah.
You know.
I want to ask a little more about Hank because I have a vested interest.
Sure.
The premise is it's like a pen pal exchange between Hank and a young boy who's living in Nazi era Germany. And how did you come up with that conceit?
Well, a lot of times what inspires me to start these books or these blogs are when the Stratomatic game releases an old season. That's how 1924 came about. They were just putting that out, and I said, let me think of something I could do with that. And this was 1938. They were releasing 1938, and I was trying to think of some kind of subject matter to do with that. And I remembered that Hank Greenberg had a huge year. He was chasing Babe Ruth. He ended up with 58 home runs. And I thought, well, you know what? There is so much stuff about Jackie Robinson. There's very little. I mean, there is some stuff about Greenberg. There was a really great documentary about him. It was John Rosengrant's book. But as far as this kind of thing, there hasn't been much. So I thought I wanted to try to do something involving anti-Semitism. And came up with this idea of Greenberg corresponding with this 10-year-old kid in Austria and in 1938 when Anschluss was just starting. And he's trying to balance his chasing Babe Ruth on the field and with the Tigers in the pennant race. Actually, they weren't that good, but thought they'd be in the pennant race. And balance that with communicating with this kid who, you know, people are like disappearing from his town and being taken away. And, you know, there's a lot of drama going on and he's kind of helpless and wants to help, but doesn't know quite how to do it. And he's writing his congressman and, you know, it just seemed like a good topic, a good subject to kind of work with. And, one person who read it, who I know recently mentioned to me that he felt it could have been longer. It could have been fleshed out more into a longer story. I did the whole thing in a 6-month blog, and the story in the book is about 120, 130 pages, I think.
What kind of research did you do for this, or did you do any of this? Is this totally made up? I mean, you obviously use some elements that are historically there. But there's right. Especially no evidence that he ever corresponded with anybody.
Oh, no. That's all fiction. Some stuff was true. There was a woman, I think her name was Marjorie Nash, who would send him, every time he hit a home run, when he got into like the 40s or the 50s in the home run race, she would make these. She was an artist at a nearby college near Detroit, and I think it was Wayne State or something. And she would draw these little cartoons of him hitting home runs and send them to him. So she had kind of a relationship with him through letters. And I found this stuff on the internet that were actually, you know, on Google Images, you could see some of her little cartoons that she did. So I kind of worked that into the story. For instance, Henry Ford, a very, very well-known anti-Semite, who ran the Dearborn Independent, found a way to work that into the story. He wanted Hank Greenberg to do some advertising for Ford, and Hank was talked out of it by Phil Weintraub, a Jewish player on the Phillies, and Hank sends him a letter in the book that says, you know, politely says no. But so there are some things like that were worked in into the story, but as far as the central thing about the kid, I mean, there could have been a kid over there he was writing to, but that part I made up for the story.
And what kind of response did you get for this book?
Well, everybody who's read it, I mean, people really, really like the Dear Hank part of it. The second part of it, the Bragging Rights League, is about African American players where I took 1941 and flipped the races around and made the major leagues black. And there's a team of white all-stars having to prove themselves in the black major leagues with, you know, Ted Williams and Jimmy Fox. And that's kind of a, it's real different. Langston Hughes is the president of the United States. So I try to, you know, even though I'm doing something a little more serious with this one, try to inject a little humor wherever I can too, so it isn't just dark. Anyway, to get back, the response to Dear Hank has been really good, and the response to the blog was very good. Again, blogs are funny. Blogs were kind of a hot thing to do for a long time, and they've kind of, I don't think they are as much anymore. I don't think they get as many. There are so many of them. It's so glutted that, you know, the hits, so to speak, I don't think are as high as maybe they once were.
Well, what would you consider a successful number of hits?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you know, 500 or 600 people looking at it a day, something like that. I don't even know if that's considered success. I mean, my stuff, I do all my stuff on WordPress, and, you know, I always found that the first week or so, the hits were always the highest, and then it just became kind of uneven.
And how often would you make a point to post?
Oh, well, I would say about 3 or 4 times a week. The first one, the 1924, looking back on it now, it's hard to believe that I was actually doing that like 6 days a week. Just, it was amazing because I had to replay the actual game so I could play a game in 10 minutes, but still that's a lot of work doing that and then blogging the next morning about it. That was a lot of work. I cut it down for the next two. I was doing those about, I would say, Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays every week. That's kind of the norm. I don't know if I'm going to do another blog. I have a couple ideas.
I was just going to ask if you're working on anything now.
I'm actually writing a book now, but it's a young adult fiction that I'm going to try to get through a conventional publisher because, give that a go again after my experience with the self-publishing, which has been good for these, but, you know, I'd like to try something a little different that's not non-baseball. I do have another idea for a baseball blog like these other ones, which was going to employ 1951 and involving the Giants and Dodgers amazing race in New York. But I haven't gone to that one yet.
If people who access this blog want to find out more about you, how is the best way to do it?
Let's see. The best way is, on Twitter. My Twitter handle is JPBallnut. And the other way is you can go to I have an Amazon page. We just type my name in and go to Amazon. There, I've got an author page. It's got all four of my books right there.
And are the blogs still viable?
All the blogs are still up. Yeah, they're all still up. It'd be easier probably for me to just, quickly email you or message you the URLs for those if you want them. But, if you just type in the names of each blog in Google, and it'll take you there too. So.
Very good. Well, we've been talking with Jeff Pullman, who is author of several blogs about baseball, fact and fiction, the latest being Twin Bill, further immersion in historical baseball fiction. Jeff, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Okay, Ron. Thanks.
And that was the Bookshelf Conversation with Jeff Pullman. Tune in again next time when our guest will be Michael Leahy, author of the new book, The Last Innocence, The Collision of the Turbulent 60s and the Los Angeles Dodgers. And remember, if you have any questions or suggestions, please send them to me at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com. And remember to visit the site. I'm sorry I haven't been posting as much as usual as I delve into the Hank Greenberg project, but I promise to get back to that as much as possible, as soon as possible. Thanks, everybody. See you next time.
Boys, I'm glad I discovered this land. Gee, it's a